All stations, all stations, all call signs. This is Wrecker Actual, over. Stand by for transmission. Prepare to copy. This is American Vindicta. Hey, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the American Vindicta Show. I'm your host, Doug Thornton. So today, we are going to talk about our research group. I'm going to let these good gentlemen introduce themselves and what it is that they're doing, what we're doing as a group together, and kind of give you the backstory of how we met and where we're going forward and kind of what our specialties are with everything. As everybody knows, I really don't have any specialties with this. I'm just a pretty face. And for that introduction, we have Mr. Brent Height of Brent Height Outdoors. Brent, will you introduce yourself and kind of tell people what it is that you do on your YouTube page, the exploration stuff and caving?
Yeah, well, I'm Brent Height. I'm from North Central Arkansas. I have a YouTube channel called Brent Height Outdoors, and I try to do all things outdoors. But lately, my focus has been on working with Doug and Mondo on some archaeological surveys. We've been going in some mound sites. We've been going to some caves, and we've been having a lot of fun and learning some new stuff. We're going to a few different states, and I've had a lot of fun working with you guys, and hope to continue to do this.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Mondo, what's up, Mondo? Everybody knows what Mondo is.
You know, I don't know how I got here, honestly. my background's in Near Eastern, Middle East archaeology, but yet, you know, working with Marzulli and doing all the stuff in Peru has kind of changed some focus. But this has been great, you know, participating in, you know, certainly some of the stuff that he does. And that now that we have, you know, I met both of you guys at the Alvarino conference. I mean, God's really putting a group together. And we actually have a broader range of team. Because we have a couple different teams that we're connected with. I know we've been doing some stuff with Alvarino and as well as Marzulli. And so we have all these other – what I like is we have all these other people that are involved at different distances and different areas geographically. So it's kind of fun.
Yeah, you know, I think the interesting part about this is that I've never done caving. I've never been at archaeological digs. Yeah, that's never been my job. For 15 years, I carried a gun for the government and like exclusively just that. And I did some other things here and there. But, you know, I think it's cool because for me, it opens my eyes. For one thing, if you've never been in a cave before, that's a cool experience. That's a next world experience to be in a cave. And especially when you're, you know, half a mile deep in the ground and then you walk into a freaking underground waterfall. That was an amazing experience. And Mondo, likewise, I can't believe the amount of stuff that I've learned so far with archaeological digs and just how much it sucks to sit there. They didn't tell me in Indiana Jones that you had to sit on your hands and knees on rock. It covered with spiders. I'm still scratching every surface of my arms from the last time we were at the tomb site just recently and searching for the backside of a cave. You know, I don't know how many chiggers and ticks and things that bite you that you don't see, but I'm covered in it. But, you know, what a learning experience. You know, not only that, what a humbling experience. Mm-hmm. Because I get in my mind, and Billy said the same thing, our friend Billy, who's also up there in Arkansas near Brent, that, you know, I get in my mind that archaeologists sit behind a desk and then they learn about everything through books. Very few go out to the field. And so it's cool to see the guys going out to the field because, you know, I mean, once again, I'm a spectator at this sport. I'm not into caving. That is Brent's thing. I don't know what to do in a cave except to walk around and ooh and awe and bump my head into stuff. And I don't know anything about archaeology. So, you know, to pair you two guys up and watch you go at it, it's pretty cool. And I'm just along for the ride as a commentator. You know, that's really all I am at this point. But I think between what L.A. Marzulli is doing, the research Timothy Alberino is doing, and now we are doing our own independent research because we are our own independent research group. It's cool to see the guys get into the field and to get out from behind the webcams and the conferences and to see the guys getting in the field and getting their hands dirty. I think people appreciate seeing stuff like that.
Yeah. What I found, I think, again, reassuring, or just, you know, oftentimes, you know, professional archaeologists are, I don't know, you know, they can be condescending, they can be arrogant. That's true. I mean, any academic discipline, doesn't just archaeology, but what I find fascinating is that you might take a guy that's got a PhD and whatever in, let's say, Mississippian culture archaeology, but yet when we go talk to, again, this our guy Billy, who's a local, you know, he's been digging in these areas for 30 years. I mean, you show him a point, an arrowhead point, and he knows, oh, this is from this time, this way, this is from this location. And just the photographic memory and the encyclopedic memory from some of these local people, again, it's a matter of, you know, yeah, he might not have the academic background, but he's been in the field. It's like, oh, yeah, I dug that cave up, and I dug over here, and I dug that up. And so he knows even the specific layers. He goes, yeah, if you go into this cave and over there, this is where this layer is. So to me, it's been awesome to just join with some of the local people. And obviously, we're always looking for more local people. We're not looking for goose chases here, but so many people have contacted, especially Brent. Brent's kind of the leader in that regard. But giving us the insight into some of these places, like, oh, yeah, when I was, you know, yeah, I know my Uncle Joe's cousin or whatever, you know, they pulled out an 8-footer from this cave, you know, back whenever. And he's able to take us to these places. To me, this is just tremendous.
Brent, what is it? Why do you think in the areas that you're at in Arkansas,
yeah,
there are so many rumors, lore, legends, myths about giants in caves, from the mound builders to even, you know, people from 20, 30 years ago? We'll say, oh, yeah, you know, like your cousin. Oh, yeah, I remember when we were kids, there's one out here in this field that they excavated, and then it just disappeared. Why do you think that's so prevalent within your area?
Well, for one, I think this area was heavily populated at one time. And the reason that we have the lore and the stories that we have now is a lot because of the newspaper articles that we can pull up and find where people actually reported having done this, you know, dug up skeletons or seen abnormalities in skeletal remains and different things. So there's actually some historical facts, so to speak, that makes this lore surface, you know. So people remember things, just like when I first started into this, I went to an antique store in a small town north of me, and the man had a lot of artifacts there, but he remembered the archaeological dig that the university did in the 1970s, early 1970s, and he remembered his father and grandfather talking about the 7'4" skeleton in one cave that we went to. They actually saw it. They went to see it. They had it in local newspapers. So the fact that this place was populated, the fact that we have some kind of information written up or documents that we can refer back to, is the reason for why we have the lore that we have today. And I think that that's what, you know, locals always want to know about their local area. You always want to know the history of where you live. And so people like to talk about things like that. And that's what we try to key in on. We try to key on local stories that people have heard from their father and grandfather, and try to go investigate these places to see if we can find any evidence of truth being to that.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a lot of it that's out there that we have to navigate through the lore and through the legend. The museum at the Indian Rock Cave that we stopped at had a book filled full of Native American myths and legends and lore. And you were talking to the museum curator, And Mondo and myself were over here, and we're taking pictures of all the different artifacts, the big, huge, round stones that were found just randomly everywhere. And, you know, we stumble upon this book, right, Mondo? And in that book was just like, oh, here's a tale about a giant. Here's a tale about a giant. Here's a tale about a giant. And we're just flipping through between giants in the water, flathead giants, giants with squinty eyes, the giants that were chasing people and eating people, the cannibalistic giants. And you know, this is all within this area of Arkansas. And it just makes me wonder, like, you know, it's a shame that we can't get better contact with people from like different Native American areas and to get their experiences and their stories. And one of the things I say all the time, and I think you guys agree with me, is that, you know, it's not just the fact that we can prove the biblical narrative if giants exist and that we find them here in America, because they do. They are here. There are, and we're going to allow Mondo to talk about his Smithsonian problem. And, you know, it helps to prove the biblical narrative, which is key. It's our number one goal, right? It's number one goal. However, the Native American lore and myth and legend to be proven accurate. And then for us to say, oh, by the way, it was these guys, the elites of the elites over here in education and in government, who destroyed your places, who took your myth, your legend, your lore, and they suppressed it. That helps us with the credibility with people, that we're not here to artifact find, because we don't take artifacts. We're here for the truth. We hunt down the truth, right? So it helps our credibility when people know we're not treasure hunters. We're searching for the truth. You know, and I know you have a little bit of a story about the Smithsonian, Mondo, that you wanted to update us on. You want to go ahead with that?
Well, you know, I want to reaffirm what you said, in that even when we were down with Billy in one of the caves, him and I were in this long tunnel and heading somewhere. And then we came back out because we weren't quite ready to go all the way back. But here we were coming out of this tunnel, and you guys were at the front of the cave, and you were walking in, and Billy looks down, and he moves my foot out of the way, and he pulls up this, this point, and which I go, oh, wow, look at that. And he goes, oh, wow, this is like a once in a lifetime find. And, but for him, he's collected points his entire life. But for me, I'm interested in the knowledge. And I think that's important to remind everybody that, you know, we aren't looking to get rich. We're not looking for treasure. We're not taking anything when we're in these places. We're looking to document what we find. And that goes back to what Brent was talking about as it relates to some of the newspaper clippings, because what you do see in it really, I would say, in the academic world, you can pull out, I would say hundreds, if not thousands, of newspaper clippings from all around the country, starting from, 1860 all the way through 1950. Okay. New York Times, you name it. Any of these places have had some article that was written talking about some 7 or 8 foot giant or bigger being excavated out of some local mound. The problem is that, there seemingly is no credibility to that. And so, again, you can have a book, and there's a lot of books out there that will go over and over and over. Some books will have hundreds of newspaper articles documenting, but it's like the scholars are like, oh, big deal, yeah, whatever. That's just a bunch of sensationalism. These guys don't know how to use a measuring tape. It's all just entertainment. So what that did is, a few years ago, I began to look into some of the Smithsonian reports, because you can go online and it's pretty laborious, if you want to say it that way. But I have all of the Smithsonian reports from 1847 all the way through 1963. And there's two blends of them. One is just the simple annual report that's given. It's entitled the annual report given to the Board of Regents. and that began in 1847. Well, then right around 1879, 1880, John Wesley Powell became the first official director of what's known at back then was the Bureau of Ethnology. So what they began to do is this was like the prime time of mound excavation. A lot of unofficial and official excavations that are going on. Well, the short story is they began officially, the Smithsonian began to send out their own archaeologists to excavate mounds. I mean, there's over 100,000 mounds east of the Mississippi, all across, you know, the states. But what you find then is what I've been doing is I've been scouring all these reports, including the original Squire and Davis monograph that they did, which was the first official accepted report of the mounds of the Mississippian culture, which was published in 1847, 1848, right around there. So they talk specifically in there about the previous mound builder culture is not the Native American culture. So as you progress through, basically the short story is that, and I'm about halfway through my research, but already I have found dozens of examples where in the Smithsonian reports, they say very clearly, hey, over here at this particular spot, they give the location. The archaeologist was there. There was a 7'6" guy. Over here, there was an 8-foot guy. Oh, over here, we found a 14-pound axe head that only a gigantic person could have done. The average weight is, what, 5 pounds, maybe 7 pounds? There's another one which was fascinating where they found it says in the report, they found a skull, a giant skull, 36 inches in circumference, where the average human is around 22 inches. So, I mean, you know, that's tremendous. I mean, that's 50% larger. So what I think is interesting, and the reason I'm willing to do all this work is my goal is to present a final report on this, is simply to say, hey, the Smithsonian giant cover-up in their own words. I'm not interested in newspaper clippings. You can go somewhere else for that. I'm interested solely in the Smithsonian reports because later John Wesley Powell and his administration, really from 1879, I think he ended right around 1902 or so after he died. But he had this 20 to 25 year history of being a complete Darwinian. And so he absolutely from the beginning was against any idea of a previous race of mound builders, any idea of giants. And so he began to suppress the knowledge that was coming out. So anything that existed before, one of his coworkers that he appointed over the task was Cyrus Thomas. And he wrote his final report in 1891. And in that, it's interesting if you look, and I'm going to demonstrate this, where Cyrus Thomas began versus where he ended. Now, typically, you might say, oh, well, he's just learning the evidence. But what you have is, and this is the typical story in all the newspaper clippings. What do you have? You have, they found something, they called the state or the local archaeologist, and then they called the Smithsonian. And then the Smithsonian sent out their archaeologists, because that's what they were doing. They were researching this stuff. They come out, the local stuff, the Native American points, the other artifacts remain there for the local museums. But all of the big skeletons were taken by the Smithsonian for further documentation and research, and then never to be seen again. So the point being is when we read this, this isn't make-believe. Again, I'm going to be presenting that report probably in the next few months, I'm hoping, just in their own words. So here we are, we're hearing some of the locals that are talking about their mounds or their caves, and we're saying this is a legitimate research endeavor to do the current modern research and documentation, because we have the Smithsonian themselves acknowledging, at least probably until 1930, some of them slipped through. Cyrus Thomas, when he was the editor, he used to let some of them slip through because he did believe that there was this previous far advanced race of mound builders, which included giants. They did mathematics, you know, trigonometry. As we know, we were at the Great Octagon Mound here recently. We were doing some stuff on the 18.62 lunar cycle, looking at the way that it was designed. I mean, some very advanced mathematical stuff. And they acknowledged that the Native Americans, they didn't participate in this. Even the oral, it's interesting, even what Squire Davis, what they did in 1847, they were, you think about that, 1847, very early on, before things were expanding out to the West. I mean, you think about what, 1845 was the gold rush in California, but, you know, I'm from Oregon. Oregon became a state in 1859. So here they were, you know, 12 years before the Oregon became a state, Oregon Territory. So it was very still frontier land. Well, they're talking to these frontier Native American tribes all around. And they're saying in their book, the Native Americans tell us they had nothing to do with these mounds. There was a previous group of people that were different than them. So needless to say, as we like to say, we're on the trail. It's fun. It's exciting. And we're going to be continuing to do it. So that's kind of the background. More to come.
Brent, you got anything to add? Because I'd like for you to to tell people about caving and update people kind of where we're at with the caves in Arkansas and what it is that we're expecting to find. And also just to let people know how dangerous it is. Because one day you're going to have to do a gear review. You and I are going to do a gear review on the proper things to take into caves, like the last time we did that we did not take the proper gear. But, you know, mistakes happen whenever we're trying to get into something to see something. But talk to us about caves.
Okay. Well, first of all, I'd like to add something to what Mondo said. Even our president, Abraham Lincoln, started a speech off one time talking about the extinct race of giants whose bones fill the mounds of North America today. So there's another credible person speaking about a race of giants, but this is back prior to the things that are taking place where things starting to get covered up and later in time. So it seems as if when you read these newspaper articles from way back there, that these people are, they're speaking of this as this is, as if this is common knowledge, you know, these things are coming out in the newspaper. And then there's this frenzy that starts up. And a lot of these people start going exploring these mounds on their own and not documenting anything. And they're looting is what they're doing. And they're collecting artifacts because there's a value to these things. And times were hard. And so they're going to do what it takes to make some money. And so this popularity of this stuff, everybody knew it was true. A lot of people were going out finding evidence of it. And then it seems like it gets to a certain point and this stuff starts getting covered up. So having said that, going to the caving, I got introduced to caving several years ago. I had no interest in it whatsoever. Never thought that I would want to enter a cave until I visited a national park. And there was this guy, he was dressed up like a ranger. He was a park ranger of some sort. He was walking around, he had a clipboard. And I seen him talking to my sister and my niece, and he signed something on the clipboard, and then he walks off. So I walk over to my sister and niece, and I'm like, "So what did that guy want?" And she said, "He's a park interpreter. He's giving a cave tour tomorrow, and he's trying to find people that want to go check out a cave." She's like, "Do you want to go?" And I was like, "Yeah." She goes, "Run over there and catch him. I think he's got more spots available." So I walk over and talk to this guy. And I sign up for the cave thing. Well, we take this 2.5 mile walk through the woods the next day, and it's hot, and this guy's real fast paced, and we're all trying to keep up. And we come to this little bitty hole in the ground, and he goes, "Here's the cave." And we're like, "What?" And he's like, "This is the cave." And so we get down on our bellies, and we belly crawl head first down into this hole. And, you know, he goes first, so we follow, and I'm not knowing what to expect, really. And then all of a sudden, we stand up in a room, and there's stalactites hanging from the ceiling, and everything's dripping with water. And I was like, "This is cool." And so, after this camping trip, we go home, we talk about this, and we share pictures with each other. And I was like, "You know, I'm gonna go back up there and talk to that guy again. I've got some friends that might want to do this." And he said there was another cave that we could go to. So I ended up driving back up there and meeting with this guy, and him and I become real good friends. His name is Chester Beck. I hope to introduce both of you to him soon. But he taught me what I know about caving. And yes, Doug, it is dangerous. As you guys experience, things can get real slick. You can lose your footing in a hurry. And I told you guys that day, I broke all my own rules. We didn't have on the proper equipment our first day in up there. And I did not expect, I mean, I'd been in the cave that we initially went to before, and I knew that we could stand up in that. I didn't know about the other room at that time in that cave. But then we went to a second cave, which I had been in, into also. And, but I hadn't been as far back as we went that day. And so we just left our gear in the truck, basically. I didn't think we would need it because I had stood up in both of these places before. And, but we actually ventured in a little farther. And once we got to where we were crawling, I was like, we should have proper gear on. We don't need to do this again. So, like I said, my friend Chester is, he's what I call a master. He has mapped caves. He has, found new cave systems. He's been hired to document caves. He's worked for the federal government in caving. He's done bat surveys. I mean, this guy, he knows that he's actually an amateur geologist. Actually, he doesn't have a degree in it, but he knows a lot about geology, and he's biblical based. He showed me evidence of backflow in some caves that proved that there was a flood at some point and the water receded back down into the earth. I thought that was pretty cool. He showed me a track that's in rock. It was mud at one time, but of a short-faced bear, which is an extinct bear that once lived in the Ozark Mountains, a huge bear. These things stood 12, 15 feet tall. So that was really cool. When you go caving, you need to have proper lighting. He taught me things like what to carry in your pack. We carry a garbage sack, a big hefty garbage sack, not only to pick up trash in, but you can put this garbage sack around you and you can light a candle and stick it between your legs and sit in the sitting position there with this bag over you, and you can keep yourself from getting hyperthermia. Our caves in North Arkansas stay a pretty much constant temperature of about 52 degrees year round. But if you're in a cave long enough, that's enough of a low temperature to cause you to develop hyperthermia. So, we carry webbing. It's a 2,500 pound test. Each person has 25 feet of this in their bag. And in the event that somebody falls and slips down maybe 40 or 50 feet, we can tie our webbing together, hoist somebody out of the hole with it. We carry water, we carry food, we carry multiple sets of lights. I mean, you want lights, you want extra batteries. If something were to happen and you were to get trapped in there, it'd be nice to have some food. You can survive quite a while without food. But you have to have water, and there's water in the caves, and we have ways to filter the water. You know, some people think that most people assume that if water's coming out of the ground, out of the spring, that it's pure, but you treat all water as if it's contaminated, and especially in caves, because caves are actually like an underground sewer system. There's bats in caves, so you have guano in caves, and you have different animals living in the caves that put waste into the water or whatever. So you can't, just because you're underground and you got water bubbling up doesn't mean it's pure. So you always need to have a way to purify water. And then another thing that he taught me that we always practice is when you go into a cave, you call somebody who knows where that location is, tell them you're going to be there, tell them what time you expect to come out. And they know if you don't call them at the expected time that you are supposed to come out, then they need to come looking for you. So the cavers, now there's you have what people like to say spelunking. Spelunking is a practice that takes place when speleologists get together and study a cave. Cavers are more, I'm going to say, hardcore than that. A lot of times they call cavers to go get spelunkers when they get stuck. I shared a video with you guys the other day that was some extremely hardcore stuff.
Doug cannot fit in those places.
Yeah, really tight places, and there was a lot of avalanche potential in these caves. I stay away from stuff like that. Those guys were crazy, in my opinion, but they were what you would call a caver. They were hardcore. I don't do stuff that hardcore. I've been in some really tight places, but if there's a lot of loose rock and some 30-foot drops underneath that loose rock, I'm not going in it. Caves are fascinating, but you do have to consider your safety, and you shouldn't attempt this unexperienced. I've been back a mile or so deep in caves, probably mile and a half, maybe. You can get in trouble back there, and if people don't know where you are, then you can perish in a cave. So it's something to take seriously, but it is fascinating.
You know, one of the things we have to talk about with caves, though, is a lot of people will ask, why are you guys in caves? You know, and we tell people, we're looking for giant bones. We're not hiding it. That is what we're looking for. You know, if we wanted an artifact find and get pottery or spear points, bird points, your man right here, Brent Height, can walk just down any road in Arkansas and pick one up. I've seen him do it. And it's frustrating because I can't do it. And me and Mondo tried. We don't have the X-ray vision into the ground. But you know, one of the questions that was asked to me one time is, do we actually expect to find a giant, you know, half a mile deep into the ground? And my answer to that is no. I don't think we will, because, you know, the way I see it is, I'm 6 foot tall. I'm 2 feet wide. I'm 300 pounds. If I can't fit in some of these places, I don't expect the 8.5-footer who weighs 500 pounds to fit in them. Like the cavers that you're talking about, the hardcore guys, they're like 5'8 and 120, 130 pounds. They're tall, they're lanky, and they can just snake their way into cracks and crevices that there ain't no way this country-fed boy is going to fit into them. Just, that ain't happening. But at the same time, that's not the area that we want to be in. We don't want to be in so far deep that we're actually wasting our time and we're just exploring. You know, that's, and people don't understand, like, we're doing all this ourselves. We don't get paid to do this. This is all on our own dime. To have somebody to sponsor an expedition is awesome. But you know, this is all our own independent research. So when you see us out there crawling through the mud, or like me and Mondo just recently, you know, breaking our backs trying to dig into whatever the heck it is that we're at in the tomb cave, you know, that's all on our own dime. And you know, we can thank people like L.A. Marzulli for being there to assist us, and you know, using his guidance and working in these areas. But it just comes down to, you have to have the love for what you're doing, or this is hard work. I mean, I think me and Mondo are still hurting from the last time we were digging. Yeah, Mondo, how long were you hurt for after we got out of the tomb?
Oh, man. I actually, it's been 2 weeks. And
you were still hurting when we were in Ohio.
Yep. I couldn't stand for too long.
We were both aching when we were up there. I didn't go on the trip that you guys went on and worked so hard. I was on the one before that, but we were both hurting a couple weeks later, I know.
Yeah. I finally, today was the, after 2 weeks and a day, I finally was able to go running again. And, but you know, we were, you know, Doug and I were bent over in this cave that was, I don't know, 48 inches, 50 inches tall, you know, digging out literally thousands of pounds of fill, trying to expose, you know, this back entrance of this cave, which we're thinking is a tunnel. And again, like you said, this isn't easy. You really have to be committed to the cause. And thankfully, we were able to dig it down enough to where I could sit on I brought a little stool. I was able to sit there. My head's here. Sorry, Doug. Doug wasn't quite there yet, but. And then we were able to, with our picks and, you know, we're getting an auger next, electric auger, in order to just to get into some of this area. And, you know, it's fun because, you know, when we were, you know, in this other area that we were in, you know, which was near there. You know, we hear about these, you know, giants being in the area. And so we're up excavating in some of these cliff dwellings and, you know, finding lots of, I found some really nice pieces of pottery with handles, you know, certainly lots of charcoal, but beautiful shells that are used as like spoons that were under, you know, normally in a lot of these caves, as you guys know, when you come into some of these caves, it can be relatively dangerous for a couple of reasons. One is just because of all the stuff that Brent described. But secondly, you know, there's water that comes down in many of the ceilings of these caves and you see it dripping. Well, you have all these different pressure changes throughout the, you know, the millennia even. And so a lot of times the roof will finally just fall. And when it falls flat. And then, of course, I mean, you're talking, you know, several tons of weight. But the great thing about it is it'll seal in whatever artifacts or material culture is there. So what we try to do is to come other and dig underneath that. But then you're kind of digging in and this thing's hanging down. And you got rocks that are kind of just hanging there, you know, several, you know, 800 or 900 pounds hanging by just a little, they have a little bit of a thing on there. But, you know, when we found, again, the piece of pottery or other things, you're like, hey, this is real, man. This is the real deal. And to find one with a handle, we took it to some archaeologists in that were part of the University of Arkansas system and showing it to them. And they're like, oh, and we were able to, you know, Brent, you could talk about that. We were able to get access to check out a storage facility from the University of Arkansas where they had, oh, man, you can 20,000, 15,000 square feet of space of all kinds of rows. And so here we are talking to them, showing them what we were finding. They're like, we don't have anything like that. That's really unusual. And especially for the area that we're finding it in. So we definitely are, again, looking to document some of this stuff.
Yeah. I mentioned to you that what you found looked more like something that would come from the Levant, you know.
Yep.
It didn't look like something that would have originated here just because of the shape and the style. We went through that big museum, or it's actually an artifact storage facility. It's not open to the public. You have to have be a research team and have to have an appointment to get in this place. They made us put on the gloves and the whole nine yards, but I don't recall seeing anything like what you found. And there was a lot of pottery in there.
Yeah. You know, it's because, You know, I've done excavation in Israel, and the stuff that as you mentioned, the stuff that I found there was very similar to just the style of a Near Eastern context. But, you know, we saw almost every kind of pottery that there is as it relates for the last 2,000 years in the, you know, east of the Mississippi River, all the different typical Native American cultures. And they were like, this doesn't fit. And then, you know, one of the things that we saw there, we took some pictures of it, but some of the giant spearheads that they had, which were very similar to other things that have been documented in other contexts. And they really had no idea or really nothing official. You know, a lot of times, you know, hey, we're not know-it-alls, you know, and as archaeologists, they're like, hey, we'll give you our best guess, but we don't know. We weren't there. Sometimes you can find it in the context, but a lot of times there is no provenance or, you know, source stratigraphy where this stuff is pulled out, where you can have some sort of context to it. But we found what they showed us was some gigantic. I mean, I put my hand up next to it and it was easily this tall. And so the typical answer when something is big and she said it herself, oh, this certainly wasn't held by a normal person, by a normal man. So the typical.
It was ceremonial is what she said.
There it is. It's like the magic. Oh, it was
ceremonial.
Now, there's no doubt that there are ceremonial objects.
Right.
But this thing didn't look ceremonial. It looked like it had activity.
Right. It was crude. Most ceremonial pieces are perfect. You know, they it's the best of the best. And sometimes it is larger than normal, but this piece looked like it was designed to kill a mastodon or something. I mean, it was huge. There would be a giant shaft that it would have been connected to, and it would take a powerful man to hold this thing or to carry it or, you know, to throw it.
Do we want to talk about the strange skulls that were in the museum?
Okay. I'll give you a little backstory to our visit to this museum. About 10 years ago, I was doing some research. I was actually researching the cave that you and I, or both of you guys and I, visited first, the one we call the IRC cave. And that's the one that has the writing on the wall, which I believe is Ogham. And I illustrated that in my first video in Exploring in Arkansas, episode one. And I think Doug has a video out with some of that on there. Anyway, so this cave, I found a book in the local school library. It was a retired history book. And so this history book tells that in 1932, a geologist took some students in this cave, and they kind of documented an excavation, and they said that there were mummies in the cave. They were wrapped in hemp and feathers, and they said they were different than us, is what it says. It says they had larger jawbones, larger skulls. And anyway, so the story caught my interest. So I said, well, this is right here local. I'm going to go investigate some of this. So I go in and investigate, and I found a site number on a plaque there. And so the site number, I looked it up online, and it led me to the Arkansas Archaeological Society, and that led me to contacting some person there at the university. And so I asked the people at the university, I said, so do you have a list of artifacts that are associated with this site number? She said, yes. And so I asked her if she could pull it up. She had a computer there in front of her. She pulled it up, and I said, can you tell me if there are any mummies listed? And she said, mummies? And I said, yeah. And she goes, there is. And so when I read about the irregular skulls, and she said that they had some on site, but she said I'd have to make an appointment in order to see them. And so that lay dormant for a while. And then when I got connected with Manu and Doug, and we started discussing things with LA, I resurfaced this story and dug back into it, and I ended up making an appointment at the university to come see these peculiar skulls. And so they tell us that we can't, because we'll have to get tribal permission in order to see the remains, because they assume that these are the remains of some the local tribes here in Arkansas. So we got to go to the museum. We got to see the artifacts, but we have not yet got the tribal permission to see the elongated skulls. And we're still working towards that. But that's what led us to the museum. And that's what we were there to see, actually. And hopefully, with a little luck on our side, we will get to see them one day.
Mondo, let me ask something. I've put my hands on the elongated skull that L.A. Marzulli has, and you've done testing on these things. And it's freaky to hold. It's not right. And just holding it, you just go, this is alien in nature. Not saying it's a gray, but it's alien in nature, right? I think there's a link between the things that are found out on Catalina Island, between what we're finding out here within the Arkansas Mound Builder area, and you know, Brainchild Brent here is the one who's leading us to all these. If you guys just knew half the stuff that Brent did and knew, Brent himself is a movie. So one of these days we're going to talk about some of that other stuff, Brent. But I think there's a link between the elongated skulls from the West Coast, the stuff that was found in Paracas in Peru, and to a certain tribe that possibly Joshua himself, after crossing the River Jordan, encountered. Do you think that's accurate? Do you think these things may all be connected some way?
Well, a couple things. As far as I've ever seen in the literature, in at least in Israel proper, I haven't seen anything that would relate to a elongated skull in Israel. However, one of the things that, you know, I personally, I mean, have handled and took material from 17 different elongated skulls. And then we had one that was given to us. The material was already extracted. So most of the skulls that we had, there were some that were in North America, but most of the skulls that we had were down in Paracas in Peru. But then what was interesting is, you know, part of that project, kind of, this is kind of a long answer, but the part of that project was the Peruvian government. We were at their regional museum in Ica. And this was, again, a regional museum out of the National Museum in Lima. But we went in there and we were well prepared. And they gave us 10 elongated skulls from their collection to extract from. So, I mean, it was a very official process. A lot of stuff. But they obviously trusted us enough and our research team to do it. And of the 10 skulls that they gave us, one was not really, like you said, some of them you're just like, okay, this is just kind of a normal skull. But we tested 9 of them. And of the 9, 5 of them, now this is the interesting thing. This is what the long answer. Of the 9, 4 came back haplogroup B, which is pretty standard for all of North America into South America, coming across the land bridge up by Alaska, Beringian land bridge from, you know, China and the Mongolian region. Very standard. But the other 5 came back as being from the Middle East. Now, particular group, as well as some of the other ones that we had, like, for example, the baby skull that we did, that came back as part of, again, there was a haplogroup X, which is part of a specific group of people known as the Druze, which lived all throughout Israel. So even though there's never been any documentation necessarily of elongated skulls that I've seen being excavated, it's interesting that several of the skulls that we had that were in Peru show themselves from the mitochondrial DNA, the mother's side, being from the Middle East. Secondly, it's well documented that there are elongated skulls up in the Caspian region and the Caspian Sea up the Black Sea area, all that, you know, basically Ukraine, Georgia, you know, the country Georgia, even on the southern side, Turkey, etc. So what's interesting to me is that, and people have shown that there's elongated skulls in every place in the country. I'm only telling you about what we personally experienced. So the question then is, how did they get across here? And we did some carbon 14 on some of these, and they were 2,000 years old. So it's just interesting. Now, Israel proper, no. But the if you were to do the greater Middle East area, absolutely. No doubt. And again, some of those skulls, the DNA ended up, the descendants ended up being in the country of Peru, down that for at least 2,000 years. So, you know, connect the dots. You know, I've been reading, you know, I like to read some of the academic literature in this area. And, you know, this isn't the only, you know, there have been other groups that have done, especially from UCLA, that have done some DNA testing of the Paracas skull as well as the Nazca culture. You know, we've all heard about the Nazca lines, you know, that you can see from the sky. But it's interesting that those two cultures intersect in a very brief way. But it's interesting that I had emailed and reached out to one of the directors that was doing some DNA testing of some of the skulls. And I simply asked one simple question. Hey, you are highlighting and documenting the DNA history, the indigenous history of these peoples. Did you test any that were elongated? No answer. And I know that they heard from us because this same person, excuse me, was in contact with LA. So at the end of the day, you know, the research that we did shows a absolutely 100% Middle East link between what you have over there and what's being found over here.
Guys, we got about 1 minute left. Why don't we tell people what it is that we have in future in store? And after that, you're just going to have to stay tuned because we're only uncovering cooler stuff. I mean, what we have coming up soon, going back with Billy into some of the other caves, the petroglyphs. You know, I swear, I think Billy said that there's a petroglyph of a pterodactyl that's on there that I want to see. If so, I'm going to put my face right next to it for a freaking selfie because that's awesome. 1 minute, what do we have left or what do we have coming up next? And what do we think people should be looking forward to with our expeditions? And what do you think we're going to end up uncovering soon?
Brent, why don't you kind of give a summary of what we have in the Arkansas area, and then I'll give a summary of the rest of the stuff.
Okay, so there's actually several things we could cover, but I think some of the things that are at the top of the list, one is revisiting the cave with Billy and seeing some new caves in that same area. Also, I mentioned my friend that's the caver. He actually explored a cavern in that area that as far as I know, as far as he knows, he's the only one that's ever been in it. He discovered it in a creek bed. Another thing that we want to try to investigate is there is what I believe to be a serpent mound that's very near where I live. We'll have to go there by boat. I plan for us to go up on top of a mountain and view it from the mountaintop and then actually get in a boat and go out to it. I've actually found artifacts on this feature, I guess you would call it, that's out in the middle of a lake. It's you can look at the satellite images. It looks just like a snake. There's some mounds that we have yet to explore in the area where our friend Billy is. And we hope to be able to explore some of those. And then if time permits, we have a gentleman that's reached out to us from southern Missouri, which is also in the Ozark Mountains, that wants us to try to investigate some caves on his property.
Yeah, I mean, we have Brent and I were in Ohio just a few weeks ago. And we did, again, as we mentioned, we did some stuff at the Great Circle Mound. We were at the Octagon Mound and we were studying some of the archaeoastronomy there. And that's definitely, we're currently at a cave that's in eastern Oklahoma that is what we're calling a tomb cave, potential vault cave, because one of the fascinating things about this particular site is that when you get back in the recesses of the cave and you look out, we're able to take some compass bearing readings and headings, and we were able to connect that with some software, astronomy software, and see that, you know, on the summer solstice, as the sun sets, the light shines directly into the backside of this cave. I mean, it's pretty fascinating. We're you know, when we were in Ohio, we were excavating, we're doing some test pits on a mound there, which kind of ended up being a bust. There's a lot of things that are just hills. Okay, they are. But we have another two or three mounds that we're looking at in the Ohio area. Ohio is well known. There's over 20,000 mounds in Ohio itself. So we have a variety of things that we're looking at. Again, what's the goal? The goal is just to document and to research and to take pictures and to take measurements and to show the magnificence of some of these, especially astronomy and the mathematics of some of these places that are far beyond. Even, again, you know, one person on our team, she's Native American. And she's like, we don't have this stuff in our history, in our old history. So we're able to interview her. We did some stuff with the Newark Holy Stones, and not saying that they're real, but we did some documentation on that, some study of that back and forth. So, we're you know, it's exciting times.
You know, I look forward to cooler temperatures because it was brutal over the summer trying to do this. And in some of these places, we have a time limit because when the rain season comes back, like at the Tomb Cave, we may lose every bit of progress that we've made. And wow, is that going to be frustrating. I mean, I think at this point, we're probably close to 350 5-gallon buckets worth of field dirt that we're covering by hand at times, and rocks and boulders. I mean, it's incredibly frustrating to lose that. So it's time sensitive in certain areas, but you know, we can't spend all year on one cave. because there are so many. Like you said, there are so many different artifacts and places that are out there for us to go to. And there are other states that we want to go to. There are other places that we want to go and hit because we think we'll do it right. And we'll uncover these things the way it should be and not, you know, over fantasize about everything, I guess you could say, you know, not make everything about some long distance type of idea. We really just want to just uncover what it is. Having the fact that, you know, Brent knows everything about caves, that makes me feel better, makes me feel safer. All right. Yeah, because Brent is the safety guy, you know, and when Brent sees, you know, me and Mondo crawling around like a couple of kids, you know, he has to, you know, pull the reins back occasionally. And it's good to have that. But it's good to have the astroarchaeology part of this, you know, to see how things lined up in the tomb cave. And I mean, you called it the night before. We're sitting at your dinner table. We're taking measurements to see what we think it is. You know, we're drawing up little diagrams of what possibly the shaft from the tomb cave could be and what it could be relatable to. You know, I feel like I'm Indiana Jones again. It's given me a new reason to want to get up and break my back all day and set a place that I'm not meant to fit in. So I'm enjoying it, fellas. I think we're going to have a lot of cool content to come, and that's going to be starting here soon within the next couple of weeks, right? We're going to be at it again. Yep. So you're going to see a lot more of our pretty faces. We're going to have a lot more of the videos of caves and other places that Brent has lined up for us. Brent Height at Brent Height Outdoors. Brent is a modern day explorer. This man has done way more in his lifetime than I have done yet. And I'm just trying to catch up. And Mondo Gonzalez of Prophecy Watchers, and everybody should be very familiar with Prophecy Watchers and Mondo. You know, we collaborating together, we make up a team that is unlike anybody else that's out there. So I think we have a lot of experience that we bring to this field and a lot of spunk, which is, I think, is what's missing. It's not entertaining to watch a lot of these guys. We're entertaining. So if you're bored, watch us crawling around in caves trying to find stuff that people say don't exist and watch us prove that it does. So, ladies and gentlemen, that's all we got for right now. Mondo Gonzalez, Brent Height, I'm Doug Thornton. Thank you very much for watching. Have a good one.
All stations, all call signs. Prepare for transmission. This is Wrecker Actual. Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine. I will repay, saith the Lord. End of transmission.